Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. Hello and welcome. It's another one with various dogs in various houses, so sorry if you get a bit of squeaking in the background. It's not us, honest. Well, sometimes actually it is. Hello, Susie.
Hello. Good morning.
I wanted to start off by referencing back to last week, this thing about lack and greed. Mm-hmm. And actually it's beautifully demonstrated in the book of Exodus, which is the most amazing mystical text from the point of view of the whole leaving of Egypt, going into the wilderness and then coming to your promised land, because it's an allegory. Whether it ever happened or not, we really don't know. But the whole idea of going out into the wilderness is about stepping away from the tribe and addressing the new and engaging with free will. And there's a whole lot more to that, but there's that was Saffa. There's this story of the manna from heaven, and the word manna means what is it?
No, really?
Yes, it doesn't mean bread at all. The Hebrew word is what is it?
The what is it from heaven, that's hilarious.
The what is it from heaven. And the idea was that the manna fell to feed them, and it came in the form that they needed. So for children it came in milk, and for grown-ups it was quail, and for the elderly it was a form of gruel. It was never meant to be bread, and it does make that quite clear. So you got exactly what you needed or who you were. And you were told not to gather more than was necessary.
Mm.
But you didn't gather it on the Sabbath, so you could gather enough on the Saturday. Day before. Mm. Friday in those days.
Sorry.
It's all right, it doesn't matter. It's one of those silly things that we do, is pick each other up on a tiny point and miss the whole great big thing. Sorry about that. But if you gathered more on the previous day than you needed, apart from the day before the Sabbath, it went mouldy.
Wow, yeah. Very much what we were saying.
Exactly. And I just love bringing it back and saying we miss this stuff in these holy texts. Of course, stuff like that's in the Bhagavad Gita and many other holy texts as well. It's just that my training is about the Bible.
Well, and what it says is that it's always been true. It's always been true and we've always needed to hear it.
Yes.
Which on the one hand is devastating and on the other hand is slightly reassuring.
Yes.
I remember that I've got some random things that belonged to my great-grandmother. I'm enormously privileged, basically, to have inherited some beautiful, beautiful things from a family who definitely could be accused of being a squirrels in that some of us find it kind of hard to let stuff go when it belongs to a beloved elder.
Mm-hmm.
And so, amazingly, I have my great-grandmother's cookery book, which I totally treasure. I love it. But in fact, I've got the one she wrote in and just a book that she had. And in this book, it's so old. I can't remember when it's from, but it's got to be a good 100 years old, this book. I opened it one day and there's the injunction to eat seasonally. And I just thought, oh no, really? Even 100 years ago, we weren't managing to do that? Really, really blew me away.
Yeah.
That even back when it must have been so hard not to eat
seasonally, you still had to be advised.
That you still had to be advised to do so.
Yeah. That, and this is grace too, because previously when we've been together, been eating my rock buns, which come from the Biro recipe book, which was published in 1935, which belonged to my grandmother. And only today, having made some more of those, I'm sorry you can't have them, but after lockdown, I promise you will. Only today I posted a picture of it on Facebook, that very old book from 1935, saying this was my grandmother's and it just is redolent with memories of my childhood. And more than 20 other women have come along and said, yes, I remember that book. And I've got one from my grandmother.
Awesome.
So this one's about grandmother wisdom, I think.
Yeah. Well, and recipe books, you know, because a recipe book has always reminded me of the kind of the grimoire, you know, the recipe book for life, if you like. And I think there's much in the old recipe books and in modern recipe books, actually, there are there is so much that you can take out into life generally in any recipe book. And in a way, it's much like the books that go with the tarot decks and the oracle decks. There's always so much more wisdom in there than just here's the meaning for this card, here's yes. the meaning for whatever. And that we've got amazing access to more information about the past than we know just through things like recipe yes. books. It's amazing.
Yes.
I got really excited once, and I don't know what happened to it, and I'm very sad that I lost it. But once upon a time, just briefly, I had an Elizabethan cookbook, and I made some of the recipes. Oh, my God. There was this one in particular for a kind of apple cake. It was insanely delicious. But it took ages because you had to peel and core and chop up your apples. But then you don't throw away any of that. You melt it all down to this exquisite kind of goo.
Syrup? No.
Not really, no. It became a sort of a... I don't know.
A gooey base thing. Yeah.
A gooey yeah. thing, which you then had kind of in the middle of this apple pudding, apple cake thing.
Oh.
And it was a lot of effort, but my God, it was worth it. It was the best apple cake I've ever eaten.
Yes.
And that implicit in that also is, you know, we're back to what we were talking about last time.
The master maker.
The master maker. Yeah. That it's worth doing something to the very best of your ability. And yes. that when we had more time, maybe we were more able to do things yeah. to an even better level, which brings us back round again to that thing of time. We need time. Yeah. We need time to do life well. We can't be forever on the hamster wheel of achievement. Yeah.
And some of it comes down to possessions. I'm looking around my office at the moment, and it's fairly cluttered. I've got lots of pictures and icons on the walls and lots of books. And because I have so many possessions, and I like them, but they all take time to dust. And if you lived a lot simpler, there'd be more time.
And okay, you spend less time dusting. Or you don't care dust. Less about the dust.
Well, there is always that, but occasionally people do come round, even nowadays. Yeah. And then I panic and dust, which is another thing I should just sort of say, it's the way the house is. But on the slow cooking thing, back when I was ill a few years ago, back then I was still making marmalade every year to a recipe from my mother, which probably came from other... an old elderly lady. She knew it wasn't from her mother, but it was a handed down recipe written down on a piece of cardboard.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great one because you chopped up the whole of the orange. You used it all, apart from the pips. But right. actually, you used the pips in a muslin bag to
set it.
To set yeah. it. But you actually chopped up the whole orange, and I could do that in a mixer. And it makes a very dark coloured marmalade, and you add a bit of treacle to it. Here we are into recipes today. But it was delicious. But I hadn't been able to make it the previous year because I'd been so ill. And that year I was also still ill. But I was utterly determined that I was going to make marmalade.
Mm.
And it took me about 3 days.
Wow.
But I did it slow marmalade. And I had to sit down every 5 minutes. And I had to monitor my breathing. And I had to take it really, really slowly. But the achievement of that marmalade was such a great marmalade. Oh, and have I talked before about the best Christmas cake in the world?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, I post a picture of that on social media every Christmas because it's an utter wreck. I managed to bake a Christmas cake the previous year when I was really ill.
Mm.
And then I iced it a few days before Christmas. And then I'm going to fess up completely here because I always tell people it was in a tin when I dropped it, but it wasn't.
Oh,
I tried to carry it to the spare room to put it in the big pot. But I just iced it. It had soft icing and I was carrying it and I wasn't strong enough. Mm. And I fell. So this Christmas cake lands on the carpet.
Oh no.
And two beagles come up with grater, and I'm trying to push the beagles away, and it's such a calamity. But I'm sitting there on the floor holding the beagles away, shouting for Lara to come, and then suddenly it cracked into laughter.
Yes.
And I just laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed. And Lara then took the beagles and I picked up this cake and sort of put it back together because it was broken in three places and all the icing was sogged. So I sort of scraped off bits of the icing and put it back together. And you've never seen such an ugly cake in your life. It was the best cake ever. because every time we looked at it, we laughed.
Yeah.
And we didn't mind eating it with our own dog hairs in it. We just picked them out of our teeth because they're our dogs and our germs, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it this hunt for perfection that we have is so ridiculous. But, oh, the best cake ever.
Wonderful. Glorious. There's, yeah, I'm really noticing how much I'm minding. Sorry that my dog is whining.
Oh, I don't mind.
No, I know, but it's the hunt for perfection. I want this podcast to be really, really good. Mm. I want there not to be a whinging little dog in the background.
Yes, I wanted to be able to edit Sappho out a few weeks ago when she barked, but we didn't leave enough space other side of the barking for it to be done without chopping out a whole load of stuff you'd said. So that didn't happen.
Yeah.
So we are gloriously imperfect.
We are gloriously imperfect.
And it's perfect that we're imperfect. Oh, vomit.
Yeah, my poor little dog, though, he's become... I think I already said on some other whinge-filled podcast that he's become just the most extraordinary love limpet following the death of our beautiful Lurcher. Come on, sit up here. And he
sound just... effects are supposed to be very, very attractive on podcasts.
Are they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the sound effect of a Border Terrier.
Oh, look
mostly.
At him. Isn't he gorgeous?
He's so gorgeous. Who... really, 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 really wants me to be doing something other than sitting here talking to you.
Yes.
He doesn't really mind what it is, but he'd like me to do something else. Can you either come here or stop, please? Good boy. But yeah, I think we're all missing Daisy horribly, and
I think that he is demonstrating, this will probably be broadcast when we're out of lockdown, I hope, but he's demonstrating how a lot of people feel being stuck on their own.
Yeah, I do think that's it. I think he's just really, really missing the company of another dog.
Mm.
So the company of the humans has become kind of super important to him.
Mm. Well, it's the same with Sappho because she came from a pack. So she was with 30 other dogs, 30 other hounds. So to come here...
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
And she does, you know, she has attached to us, but we will get another hound as well. To be her companion. Now, of course, being me, I'm worrying that she won't want the other hand by the time it turns up because I'm good at worrying about that kind of thing. But I know it will be fine. I know it will be fine. But we change the lives of these animals by bringing them into our homes, don't we? And I think they are our homeopathic vet, Judith Webster, is a wonderful woman, says that she's quite sure that hounds and other dogs are... changing in their evolution because of being in our homes.
Right.
But they are becoming more individuated.
Right.
Which makes sense because everything evolves.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
I don't know.
It's really interesting. I've heard you say that a few times, and each time I've noticed in myself a massive resistance to the idea that it would be desirable to be more individuated.
Well, that's what I was just saying. Is it actually being evolved, or are we harming them?
Yeah. Yeah, big question.
Big question. But it is what it is, and we have got animals for pets, so we need to work with it, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
What best we can do.
Or perhaps become, I don't know, strive to become less individuated ourselves or something? I really don't know.
Well... linked to each other, individuated and linked to each other, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there, as I understand it, there are people living, I'm guessing, in Africa who don't perceive themselves as individuals.
Mm.
And they their worldview has the people as one being... I think perhaps in the way maybe that one might perceive a hive of bees as being one being.
Yes.
And the individuals just simply don't matter.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have an individual identity. Your identity is as one of the people.
That's the point in Kabbalah at which you say thy will. Because the levels in the Tree of Life are that you start out as completely dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to individuate to become yourself, to use your free will.
Mm.
And quite often we individuate too early because the vessel of our childhood isn't strong enough to keep us safe, and we have to sort of step out of it and rebel or something like that. But then when you become fully individuated, the job is to move to the soul, which is communal.
Mm.
You can be an individual and you are part of the whole.
Yeah.
So as we were saying last time, you have your individual thread to hold.
Yeah.
As one human being, but it's part of the great pargod, the great
weft of life
of creation. Yeah. Yes.
Brilliant.
I was reading the Infancy Gospel of James today, which is one of the. It was written in about 150 Common Era, and it's one of the ones that was sort of hidden away. And it's basically a fantasy fairy story because parts of it are utterly ridiculous. But it's about elevating Mary, the mother of Jesus, to be the mother of God, saying that she was conceived immaculately, mm-hmm. not by Anna's husband, and she was raised in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And that she was perpetually virgin, which, of course, is the difficult bit, but that she was weaving the veil of the Holy of Holies when Gabriel came to her. That bit I love, because it's about the Great Mother and the weave. The perpetual virginity bit drives
I thought the original meaning of the word virgin was a woman whole unto herself.
That's what I was going to go back to, yes. It isn't the Hebrew word when Isaiah says a virgin shall conceive. It's not a virgin, it's a young woman.
Mm.
It's changed into Parthenon, which is generally translated as virgin. But what I was going to say, the ridiculousness of this gospel, I love the idea of her being pure and holy and weaving the whole curtain, being part of the goddess culture.
Mm, mm, mm.
But when she gives birth to the Christ child, apparently the midwife sees a light in the room and the Christ child appears.
Yeah.
So presumably didn't come out of the birth canal. And afterwards, a woman called Salome examines her and confirms that she's still a virgin. And of course, this whole thing of breaking the hymen when you break the virginity or is a sign of being able to spot virginity is a total myth and always has been a total myth because some women have larger hymen, some don't, some keep their hymen, some have it broken by horse riding, and it's got nothing to do with virginity whatsoever. So it's one of those difficult gospels where parts of it are utterly ridiculous, but some of the magic in it is glorious.
But is the whole thing of the hymen being broken or not broken as much about the temple and the veil that she was weaving as it is about her and her virginity?
Well, that's an interesting point. Because when Jesus dies on the cross, the veil of the temple is torn when he dies.
Yeah.
So when he's reborn into death, oh my goodness, now that's fascinating. You've really made me think. I'm sitting back and crossing my arms now. But that's not in resistance. It's actually in, oh, yes, let's look at that in depth. The veil of the temple was whole until the death of the Christ figure. How interesting. Thank you. I shall
ponder. Okay, I shall look forward to an update, because obviously I have absolutely no idea what it says.
No. You probably won't get an update. I should probably do what Mary did and take these things and ponder them in her heart and just go, okay, there's another analogy in there. Yeah. Because what happens when we write things down is we tend to write down our opinion of things.
Mm.
So there's a case for weaving in and out and say, what is the perennial story underneath that? So I actually get that now, but only in the context of the rest of the Gospels.
The thing that, I mean, I can't overstate how much, in a way, I don't know what I'm talking about just because I never have read the Gospels. But just from writing when I write and reading, when I read within knowledge, the ways in which so much can be transmitted by a very few words when it's a kind of, you know, gnomic statement. So one of those things where it is partially veiled, partially hidden.
Yes.
But those who know what you're talking about get the illusion and understand a lot. And those who know nothing think it's a sort of slightly veiled, mysterious, stupid and pointless thing to say, which is of no interest. And so we'll skip on to the next bit.
Yes.
And that surely when the Gospels were being written, they were written within the context of there being people who knew what they were about.
Absolutely.
And therefore, many of the statements within them have to be gnomic in that way. So they're not overt.
Well, they're written on four different levels.
Right.
We touched on this before, I know we have, but you know, Matthew is the gospel of the physical world as it is the system. Mark is the gospel of the psyche, and Luke the gospel of the spirit. That's the one all about Mary. And John is the gospel of the divine. But if you read John as a fundamentalist, you'll say, it says, I, Jesus, am the way. No, it's saying I, the link, the Christos, the link, the way, and nobody goes that to the Father, the Mother, whichever you want to call it, except in this way, as yeah. I am.
Yeah.
You know, this is the path. Don't stare at me, follow the path. And that's always the case of how religions and all sorts of even holistic stuff come down to, which is the worship of the guru.
Yeah, follow the light, not the lantern.
Yes, follow the light, not the lantern. And my bishop has this lovely phrase which says, let's say the truth is in Jerusalem. Or just say the truth is in Jerusalem. Mm. The truth, the perennial truth. You know, the quest, the great hero's journey. We're going to find out the truth. Very few people are going to walk to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to try and find somebody who has walked to Jerusalem and sit at their feet. And if they can't find somebody who hasn't walked to Jerusalem, somebody who has walked to Jerusalem, they'll find a signpost of Jerusalem and sit down and worship that.
Oh, dear.
And I've done that. And it is what you do. I can't get to Jerusalem. And it's stupid because everybody can get to Jerusalem inside the heavenly Jerusalem. That's why I learn and teach Kabbalah, because it's actually about finding all of this stuff in you.
Mm. Which... it will be there because you are microcosm of the macrocosm.
Absolutely.
Everything that is true of the all is true of you.
Yes.
Somewhere.
Somewhere. You just got to unravel it, and layers of the onion. And of course, most of us, it's far too hard, much like hard work.
Mm.
Good beagle shake there. Well done, Safo.
So, oh, please, Tom, sweetheart, I'm so sorry. I think he actually wants to go for the dreaded W-A-L-K, which I obviously can't do, as this is our allotted moment. But yes,
you can in about 10 minutes.
Yes, I can in about 10 minutes.
It depends whether he wants the dreaded puddle.
No,
yeah, it is age.
Hopefully not. No.
new hound here, still a little virginal in the house training stage.
Yeah, no, it's a very, like... very long time, like maybe 13 and a half years or something since Druid has disgraced himself in that manner. Or, well, not that it's a disgrace when you're a little baby, but
no, it's not.
As a big grown-up dog, he hasn't so far ever done such a thing in a house, especially not someone else's.
And now, Druid, you're 2 more minutes closer to that walk.
Because terror is gripping my heart.
What have you got in front of you? I see you've got a book.
Yes. So, well, in fact, yes, let me just quickly say that, of course, he can't pee in someone else's house now because he's in his own, but he's not very likely to do it here either. So, I was encouraged by the response of people enjoying the fact that we were picking a subject from looking in a deck of cards. And I'm enjoying being able to give shout outs to the many, many decks of cards that I have by people who I know and love. So I just wanted to quickly give one to the English Magic Tarot.
Hold it up so I can see.
The English Magic Tarot.
Oh, it's got what looks like Peter Rabbit on the front. It's a hair,
it's
is
a hair,
it?
It's yes. a hair. So the English Magic Tarot, the artist is, well, the artists are Rex Van Ryn, who drew the shapes, and then Steve Dooley, who's the colourist, and they are just beautiful cards. They're very, very different, actually, from anything else I ever normally like, because it's a very kind of graphic design sort of a style.
Yes, they're sort of cartoony graphic, yeah.
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 But... really, there's lots and lots and lots of hidden magic in here. There's loads of allusions to Kabbalah in these cards. I think you would appreciate them when we finally get together.
We'll be nicking show you
the actual deck. But the words, once again, the book is so wise. And it was written by my beloved friend, Dr. Andy Letcher. And again, even if you're not into cards, totally worth reading just for the wisdom it contains. It's absolutely gorgeous. And so for our discussion today, I got the Page of Coins, which is taking off the mask, identity crisis, the call to one's true self. And he's talking about personas, and that we all need personas. We all have to move through chameleon-like through the world, but we must never let the persona take over. For if it does, something might come along, like the horse in this card, a force of nature to strip it away and bring us back to earth.
Oh, Well, we don't have that much time to talk about it.
Come on.
But that completely fits with something I was teaching in the Kabbalah group online last night, because I was trying to talk about the difference between the ego and the self.
Mm-hmm.
Tiferet, the true self, the place of truth and beauty, and yes, of the foundation, which is also the ego. And I was trying to explain it, and a good example I thought came to mind, so I'll share it here and you can tell me what you think of it. A friend of ours died yesterday. Kirk McNulty, lovely guy and a Kabbalist in America, and very dear and very sweet.
Mm.
So, Kirk's death makes me feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
Me is the ego. I is the self. Now, that's a wild generalisation, but let me sort of play it out here. That Kirk's death makes me feel sad because the ego is all about the past and about projections. It's not about this present moment. The true mm-hmm, self is about mm-hmm. this present moment. So I am sad at Kirk's death because I knew him and I visited with him with Lion and we laughed together and he gave us a great joke, which was the first time Lion ever met him at a group. He said, "Is this the line for the euphemism? Is this the cue for the lavatory?" You know, we've always... So that is the positive ego, the memory, the affection. The ego is bringing up because that's what it does. It holds the memories.
Mm-hmm.
And we react according to how we process those memories. So that is ego, but good ego. That's my persona. I grieve because it hurts me. And the second thing is I can see it's a blessing that Kirk has died because he had Alzheimer's and he was suffering mm-hmm. and his wife was suffering too. She's going to miss him dreadfully. Mm-hmm. But I can see there's a blessing. Can you see there's a detachment there?
Mm-hmm.
The true self will hold the detachment, but this is what's best.
Yeah.
And then I thought, what can I do for Chris right now, which is the true self? I would like to be of assistance. I don't need praise for it. That's back mm-hmm. to the ego.
Yeah.
What can I do to assist? I have been widowed. So I go back into the ego, the positive ego, which is what comforted me?
Mm-hmm.
Is this of use?
Yeah.
Not what do I want you to think of me in my way of comforting you, but what comforted me? And I remember that when Henry died, people sending me photographs of him that I'd never seen before was a small comfort. Because I had something new of him to look at.
Yeah. Oh, I can really see that. Yeah.
So I found a couple of pictures of when Lion and I were in Virginia visiting Kirk and Chris a long time ago. And then we got two lovely pictures of them, one of which they're kissing each other. And this really elderly couple, because they're in their 70s then, kissing. And it's just lovely. And one of them to us. So I emailed Chris and said, "Your poor, wounded, broken heart, I am so sorry.
Mm.
I found these pictures. I hope you can take some small comfort in them. No need to reply."
No.
"We love Maggie." And that's something my Auntie Beryl told me, going back to the grandmothers. Every letter she wrote at the bottom, it said, "No need to reply." And you wanted to reply because there was no pressure.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful to her for that. But that to me sort of sums up the negative aspect of the ego would have been in my needing Chris to reply
mm-hmm.
and to thank me
yeah.
and to say, "Oh, you understand how I feel," which would all be gratification for me.
Yeah.
And the freedom for me and for her in just saying, "No need to reply. Here is a gift. You can throw it in the bin if you want to. You can scream and howl and hate me if you didn't like it appropriate. That's yours."
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm enjoying that description of the ego and the true self. So I describe them as being the ego is the one typically, I guess I describe the broken ego rather than the mended ego, which is the one going, you know, "Oh my God, my dog's whining. Oh my God, you know.
What are you thinking of me?"
Yeah, does my bum look big and, you know, yada, 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 yada.
Again, what are you thinking of me?
Yeah. And then the true self, is the one sitting behind that going, "Oh, good Lord, have you not done with that yet?" Just, you know, there she goes again. And so I actually call the ego one the inspector.
Yes.
So that's the one sitting on your shoulder that was gifted to me by a dear friend years ago, a friend called Lorna Harrison, and she named him the inspector, and she used to personify and embody the inspector, and she just made him
so hilarious that I have never, ever really been able to make my to take my own inspector seriously ever since.
Good.
Because, you know, immediately you notice, oh, look, there's the inspector. It's just like, oh, for heaven's sake, you
yes.
know, do be quiet.
Yes.
And that is such a gift. In a way, I'm hoping I'm offering, dear listener, the gift of make your inspector that mask that we sometimes wear of the very, very, very self-critical one, mm. turn them into a comedy sketch.
Yes.
Because then you just can't take them seriously and your true self is what dominates more of you.
Yes.
Than
a friend of mine
inspector.
Who's into aromatherapy, there's an oil called Melissa, apparently. Mm-hmm. And she called her inspector Melissa because she found that oil very useful. And she goes, oh, here goes Melissa.
Yeah, you know, well, Melissa means something else entirely to me.
Does it? Well, there you go. It's all individual, isn't it?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But it's the same kind of thing because she's going, oh, there she is sitting on my shoulder, nagging at me and telling me I'm stupid and telling me I'm wrong.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Melissa to me is the name means bee priestess, basically.
Oh, how lovely.
And so the Melissae, the Melissa
are. Oh, is that fascinating? I love
priestesses
that.
In the temple.
Yeah.
Little devourers or whoever.
Which brings us neatly back to the whole thing of language.
Yes, indeed.
What means one thing to one woman or man means a completely different thing to another.
Yeah.
But I love that interpretation. In fact, with this woman, I can actually see with some hindsight that maybe that aspect was calling her to priesthood, which she denied and turned down.
Mm-hmm. So fascinating.
Isn't
just
that fascinating?
The whole language things. If I could have another whole life as me next to me doing the one I'm living, I definitely would get really seriously into language and semantics from this kind of magical point of view. Just
yes.
because it seems that there is, I feel like language is so, so fundamental in the constructing of our version of reality. That it seems increasingly implausible to me that there not be some kind of fundamental language of truth.
Mm.
And that there must be, in a way, well, there clearly are universal sounds.
Mm.
So if you go all around the world, almost all of us all over the world have named that one, the one who gave us life,
mm.
a sound like ma, ma, mm. ma, mother,
yeah.
ma, you know, mama, maman, mm. madre. Ma,
mm.
if you look just across the tiny thing that is my life and all the people who I've taught to journey, the most extraordinary number of people who find a name for their upper world tutelary spirit, so the one that you might call a guardian angel,
mm.
their name begins with the sound A. Ah. And I find it fascinating.
Yes.
And there are, you know, I could go on and on and on and on about the ways in which the words for things, there are universalities every now and then in the sound.
Yes. And when you're trying to find a character for a book you're writing, you'll go to the beginning of the alphabet.
Really?
Automatically. So when I wrote Blue Panda, which is the latest novel, I had to go through it and change a few of the names because I had too many A's in, because I needed to keep Alicina,
yeah.
which is the name of the character based on you, on your second name, which
yeah,
is Alicina.
Yeah, which is Alicina, yeah.
And I realised that everybody else had A's or B's or C's for their names. And the main character is Amabel,
uh-huh.
Bella. AB with her friend Alicina. So I had to go all the way through and say, now come on, have a bit more imagination here and drop down the alphabets.
Wow.
So there is definitely that call to, and that's probably why we put A at the beginning of the alphabet.
Yeah, maybe.
The alpha and the omega.
Maybe. I really want to read. Have you ever read David Abrams' book, The Spell of the Sensuous?
No.
Oh my God. If you like words, and David Abrams is a man who clearly loves words, so it is his writing to me is lush beyond measure. But if you get annoyed by people who use 10 words where two would do, he might not be for you. But he wrote this book called The Spell of the Sensuous, which I actually think you would find completely fascinating,
mm.
about language, the written word, the way in which we kind of nailed reality down when we started writing.
Yeah.
And
I need to reread it because I'm sure there's far more wisdom in there than I gathered the first time I read it, which was now many years ago. But I can't encourage anyone, after they've finished Maggie's Tales of the Blue Panda, which obviously they should be reading first, not least because I'm in it. And then secondly, they could read her other new book, which is called Kabbalah and Healing.
Because you're credited, isn't it?
Sounds amazing. Oh, yeah, because I'm credited in it. Excellent. They should get right on with reading the two books written by David Abrams, which are The Spell of the Sensuous and Becoming Animal.
Yeah.
Because to me, I mean, obviously I haven't read all the books written in the last however long, but I do think they're going to turn out to be two of the most important books of our time.
Apparently John Milton was the last person in the world who could read all the books that there were.
Really? Because there were
few enough to read in a lifetime.
Wow, yeah.
Nowadays, there's a million self-published books every year.
A million?
A million.
Wow.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
It is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Do you know how many published books there are?
Not that many. But quite a lot. Nothing like a million.
Wow.
Yeah. Fascinating, isn't it?
It is fascinating. Yeah.
Well, John Romer did this Channel 4 programme many, many years ago, 70s, I think, and a book from it called Testament, where he actually called the Gospels the first loss of nerve. I actually like that, because in writing it down, you set it in stone.
Yeah.
They tried to keep the mystical aspects in it, which you will only see if you've got a mystical bent and you're willing to go right into it and watch the patterns. I mean, I do think I am the first person in the world to see the Gospels as Kabbalistic documents. Of course, I might be totally deluded, but whenever I explain it to somebody about the four levels and they go back to them, they go, oh, yeah. I got that from a book called The Four Faces of God, which was written by evangelical folk, so it didn't really appeal to me. But I just thought, four levels, hang on, four levels in Kabbalah, four words, I'm going to investigate that. Mm. But that opens up these words for me, as we were talking about earlier, about the fact that the words are just the signpost.
Yeah.
You've got to go into the spaces and you've got to walk the journey to find the heavenly Jerusalem.
Yeah, and you've got to understand that, well, even just as we so ably demonstrated now, Melissa means one thing to one person, something entirely to another.
Yes.
And that words are, on the one hand, potentially a conveyancer of extraordinary quantities of meaning and accuracy, and on the other hand, can be interpreted by different readers to mean completely different things.
Yes.
And that then again, we go back to that idea of, If they are gnomic, and of course they're gnomic, then in order to properly understand them, you have to already know what they're talking about.
Yes.
Which leaves, altogether too many of the people reading them kind of up an alley.
Yes. On which note we have to end, because we're at nearly 40 minutes.
Oh my goodness. God, they're short, aren't they? 40 minutes.
Thank you so much for listening, and was God willing, Great
see you
Mother
next
Winning.
Time, Great we'll Mother see you next Winning, week. Indeed.